Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. This week, we train our gaze on London. Storm clouds of uncertainty may be overhead in the wake of the UK's decision to leave Europe. However, a few design-minded developments are showing the British capital in a sunnier light. We catch up with the director of the forthcoming London Design Biennale, who's fostering a cosmopolitan take on the notion of utopia.
Design can't solve all the world's problems, but we thought it could at least engage with them and look at large issues that face humanities and suggest inspiring or even cautionary futures.
We also speak to The Observer's architecture critic Rowan Moore about London's growth, trajectory and the creeping challenges that need addressing to keep the city on an even keel.
We've had 30 years where we've been pushing the idea that the private sector can build a city that has given London this energy, this wealth, but it's kind of cracking at the seams, and I think it's time for another turn of the wheel.
Plus, James Taylor Foster talks unseen architecture in the city and casts some light on the biggest construction project in Europe. That's, of course, London's Crossrail, and how investing in infrastructure is keeping the UK capital moving. Lastly, we leave London to stretch our legs in Wildwood, New Jersey, and catch a glimpse of the area's disappearing doo-wop-style architecture on a wander with photographer Mark Haven. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. In the past 10 years, London has emerged as one of the world's most dynamic cities. However, economic success, left unchecked, hasn't always attended to the needs of those who call the city home. Rowan Moore is The Observer's architecture critic, and his latest book, Slow Burn City, charts the capital's unprecedented growth through its built environment. As well as musing on the city's success, he also sees the dawn of privatisation as a potential threat to the capital. He joins the show's producer, Henry Rees-Sheridan, in studio to speak about the likely effect of Brexit on London's standing and how the British capital could well become an exemplar for globalised cities the world over.
The simple way of describing the history of London is it's a kind of constant cyclical struggle between city of trade and the communities of London and the state. And what tends to happen is that business is given a free rein to create wealth, to grow the city, to create opportunities. Then at a certain point, it kind of runs away with itself, which precipitates a crisis of some sort, at which point there's some intervention. Could be a government intervention, but it can also be a popular intervention. So there's a kind of quite amazing history of citizens of London just gathering together and changing things. There's also an amazing history of interventions which are not just big and ambitious, they're also unprecedented, things that have never happened before anywhere and which having happened in London and then copied around the world. And you could mention the Building Act that came in after the Great Fire of London almost exactly 300 years ago. The most obvious one is the sewerage system that was installed in the 19th century when the river was full of sewage and people were dying in large numbers. Council housing was essentially invented in London and so on. And I would say we're at the top of another of those cycles where we've had 30 years where we've been pushing the idea that the private sector can build a city as hard as we can. And that has given London this energy, this wealth, this attractiveness. But it's kind of cracking at the seams. And I think it's time for another turn of the wheel, and most obviously to do with housing.
It is itself a centre of architecture and design, London.
Yes.
How do you think its status as such is developing and going to develop in the middle future?
Well, I think there's a great opportunity because there is a fantastic amount of talent in London, design and architecture talent, which keeps evolving. It's not just the big famous names. And there are the skills there to really help with addressing housing need. And as I say, to create models for the future that other people can imitate and follow. At the moment, those skills are not being applied as much as they could be. They are a bit. There's some boroughs like Camden and Hackney and Newham who are doing that. But yeah, really harness that talent, really invite ideas from architects who, and the younger generation of architects are pretty grounded now. They're pretty level-headed. They're not mad fantasists. They really know what the sort of practical issues are. So that's one thing. I think with housing, the most important issue is not to do with style, really, or look. I mean, it can be modern or postmodern or brick or brightly coloured or whatever. It's to do with the way you organise it, the kind of spaces you make that people share. I think there's a little bit of room for smart thinking about how, you know, what space do people really need nowadays? You know, there are different models of living that things like Airbnb have generated. You know, maybe people don't need a living room in the traditional sense. What parts of living can people share that were formerly all divided up into little houses? People are, in fact, you know, an awful lot of people in London obviously are living without living rooms because what was living rooms have been made into bedrooms. So there's some role for inventing housing types that adjust to the fact that the traditional model of a house with a garden is just not going to be available to most people. And architects can be very useful in that. Any solution you think of for housing can be good or bad, and what makes a difference is design. So a tower can be a good place to live, or it can be an eyesore, an alienating building. On the green belt can either be sprawl or it can be a garden city. And it's really design that makes the difference to those things, whether something is acceptable and desirable or not.
London's already, to a certain extent, unmoored from the rest of the UK in terms of both its operations and its psychology, its mentality. Now, the rest of the UK recently has voted to leave the EU. Yeah. That hasn't happened yet. We don't know when or if it's going to happen. Much was said about the split between London and Scotland and the rest of the UK. London and Scotland voted to stay in the EU. The rest of the UK didn't. Do you think that if Britain does leave the EU, that will affect the trajectory of development of London as a city? And if so, how?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Brexit vote was, to some degree, an anti-London vote, and it reflects the fact that London has become this kind of city-state that does actually dispense wealth to the rest of the country, but it's still kind of resented and seen as more and more alien and apart. It's really hard to know exactly what the consequences will be of Brexit vote. You know, it might slow the economy down. Obviously, it's potentially a threat to London's openness to the world. The way things are going at the moment, everyone seems to be scrambling towards a sort of Brexit light to make it as much like the existing situation as possible. The best thing you can say about it is that it creates a sort of, you might conceivably, if you're optimistic, create a kind of creative chaos, like a sort of pause in which new things can happen. But I would rather that had happened in a different way than what we've got. So there's one other point I'd like to make sort of related to that. One of the reasons why London is very, very significant now, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, is it represents, at its best, a whole lot of values that I think are very important, a lot of other people think are very important, but which are really threatened, which are the values of liberal society, of openness, of availability. And, you know, the threat is external, you know, in the kind of politics we're seeing in America, in Arab countries, in some European countries, and possibly in the Brexit vote. And the threat is also internal in that it's generated a kind of success that has been kind of monetized and exploited to such a degree that it begins to undermine that kind of openness that people like about London. So I think, you know, what happens to London is a kind of microcosm of what can happen in the world. And I think that's why it's particularly important to look at what London is and has been and can be.
That was Rowan Moore, architecture critic for the Observer newspaper in London, speaking about his book, Slow Burn City, which is available now from Pan Macmillan. In spite of the UK's decision to leave the EU, London's design calendar is looking awfully sunny this autumn. November will see the reopening of John Pawson's Design Museum, and before that, in September, the inaugural London Design Biennale at Somerset House. Contingents from 37 nations will present newly commissioned works that riff on the theme of utopia and how to address the world's biggest problems through design. Christopher Turner, a former editor of the architecture magazine Icon, is the fair's director, and he joined me in studio to talk about why London is an essential venue for the exhibition and how different nations have tackled the tricky notion of utopia.
We wanted to have a very international event that celebrated design at the heart of London. And we also wanted to adopt the Venetian model of a biennale. Venice has biennales for architecture and art, but not for design. Milan is the design capital of Italy, and they want it to stay as such. So we had this great opportunity to put on the first major design biennale in a capital city, which is astounding, really. And what could be a more Venetian location than Somerset House on the banks of the Thames? It's an amazing neoclassical palace. And within this huge campus, we've been able to fit quite a number of countries. You know, we anticipated in the first year having 20. We've got 37. And there's a real diversity of countries. All six continents are represented. We have countries from Albania to Cuba, China, Russia, Germany, the US all represented. They've really risen to the challenge of creating bespoke, site-specific installations in Somerset House that address the big issues of our theme.
And tell me a little bit about this theme. So the idea is utopia. Obviously, it's not about changing the world with one big master plan. It's about different interpretations of it that may touch on things from pollution to the state of our seas today. Can you tell us the conception behind this idea and what kind of narrative you'd like to push forward?
It's 500 years since Thomas More published his great work of political philosophy, Utopia. And utopias have become rather out of fashion. You know, we're much more interested in dystopia now. You know, films celebrate dystopias and we like picking over the wreckage of our culture in that way. But we were interested in looking at whether something might be salvaged from the utopian ideal. Obviously, we're not evangelists. We know that design can't solve all the world's problems. But we thought it could at least engage with them and look at large issues that face humanities and suggest inspiring or even cautionary futures. You know, we weren't averse to dystopias. Obviously, no one is going to submit a large social blueprint, and all those modernist utopias are obsolete. Everyone knows that utopia too often tips over into dystopia. So we wanted to address this issue and look back at history knowledgeably. There's something optimistic about design in that you address problems and try and find solutions to them. That very practical element of design, you know, might be interpreted as a utopian streak in design. And in identifying the problem, you're halfway to finding the solution. And I think that's why this theme, which does address this equation that happens a lot in design between the future and better and design, you know, there's this equation that we should perhaps be a little bit more critical of. But we wanted to address how design could make a difference on world issues and do that shamelessly.
So of these 37 countries who riffed on this idea of utopia, which ones took you by surprise? Which ones made you think? Which ones really engaged with the subject in a way that you'd like to draw attention to or that you found fascinating?
Well, everyone thinks of the design scene as this international, globe-trotting world in which everyone really addresses the same issues and talks to themselves. And what was fantastic about relinquishing some curatorial responsibility to countries is that they address specific concerns that address them. So we have, for example, Cuba. They're looking at the digital revolution that their country is facing. They obviously had the political revolution in 1959. Now they're having a digital one. They have 135 Wi-Fi spots only in the country. And two designers are looking at how to give the cloud some physical manifestation. That's a new issue in their country. In Nigeria, gas flaring is an issue. A lot of gas is just burnt off as a byproduct of oil collection. And the Nigerian team are trying to address that issue and all the pollution it causes and the billions of dollars of waste involved. Some people have looked back on their history. Chile, for example, in Allende's Chile, there was this attempt to create this room in which the economy could be controlled in real time. And they've recreated this room to sort of address this story.
I've seen some of the images, very Star Trek, isn't
it? Yeah, it looks like a set out of Kubrick's 2001. And they're going to recreate it in all its 70s splendor in Somerset House and look at this story of how to give a cybernetic spine to a country.
So a lot of these exhibitions, as you mentioned, are about storytelling, and it's a cosmopolitan tale. But unfortunately, I would argue that Britain doesn't find itself in a very cosmopolitan mood in the wake of the Brexit vote. But there are a number of openings, the Herzog & de Meuron Switch House extension, John Pawson's Design Museum. Is there a bit of a sunny disposition about London and London's ability to be a place where people consider design and have a bit more of a kind of international outlook? And how do you think this exhibition feeds into that? Well, you know, what are your thoughts?
Well, London, as you know, was overwhelmingly Remain. You know, it was a shock to us all, the Brexit vote. And since then, since we've all been coming to terms with the fact that Brexit means Brexit, whatever that means, the Mayor of London has initiated a London is Open campaign, which of course the Biennale fits very nicely into. You know, London is a cosmopolitan city that welcomes people from all around the world for events like this. And London is also incredibly dynamic in the sphere of design. There's a new design museum opening in October. There's the V&A are moving to the old Olympic site. You know, there's a lot of energy in London, and it is a cultural capital, truly. But our challenge, I think, is to how to allow that to trickle down into other of Britain's cities. You know, I think we've got to come to terms with that sense of detachment from other cities that London has. When we do hip city guides to Norwich or Birmingham, we'll have succeeded. But I think that's the challenge that we face in the next decade.
That was Dr. Christopher Turner, to give him his full title, director of London's first design biennale, which runs from the 7th to the 27th of September at Somerset House. Time now to take a break from London and turn tail for the city of Wildwood in New Jersey, a little-known enclave famed among design lovers for its colourful and eccentric doo-wop-style hotels. Defined by sharp angles, a mid-century preoccupation with space travel and neon signage, doo-wop architecture is a quirky product of the optimism of post-war America. But in recent years, many buildings completed in this style have fallen from favour, into severe disrepair or been demolished altogether. Photographer Mark Havens has spent a decade documenting these hotels, and his pictures have been amassed in a beautiful monograph named Out of Season, The Vanishing Architecture of the Wildwoods. We dispatched Monocle's Deputy New York Bureau Chief, Megan Billings, for a walking tour of Wildwood to find out more with Mark as her guide.
So here we are at the Chateau Bleu, and this is one of the motels that's actually been recognized as a historic landmark here in New Jersey. It's one of the first ones that achieved that designation, and it has a few changes to it, but by and large, it still remains the same sort of flat roof L shape with the really distinctive carport that you can see with the two points. It's got that sort of 1950s font to the signage. It also, at night, the recessed lighting under the trellises there glows pink. So it's a pink and white and blue motel. And I'm glad that it's still around, but it really is sort of the last man standing on this end of town. And it used to be as dense as the condos we drove by. It used to be all these types of motels.
I'm curious about one thing that I'm wondering if it's different. So I know, like, kind of back in the day, like in the 50s and 60s, these would have had maybe like some plastic palm trees or something like that. Was that part of the original design?
Absolutely. The first motel to have plastic palm trees down here, I believe, was the Caribbean in 1958. And that's turned into, very quickly, that turned into sort of the symbol of these motels in Wildwood. Most of them had the plastic palm trees. There's still a company down here that manufactures them and installs them and will put them up at the beginning of the season for you and take them down when things get cooler. So this is the Panoramic Motel Apartments, and it's a great example of the original masonry work on one of these motels. Sort of a beautiful, thin, undulating pattern of gray flagcrete, along with aqua doors and outward bowing railings, again situated around a pool, with a tan two-tone strapped chair and a table outside each little room, and a lot of hallmarks of what Wildwood's architecture is really about. This one remains pretty much untouched from when it was originally built.
I can't get enough of the sign on this building, mm-hmm. and it feels very Brady Bunch.
Right, absolutely. That's the signage. Was a real temptation with the book to just concentrate on the signage because so much of it was evocative. We'll see some really interesting stuff down in the crest where the blue marlin actually has a leaping fish on it, or the Waikiki actually looks like it's made out of bamboo. Those things were tempting to keep as sort of a focal point of the book, but I felt like there were so many more details that I hadn't seen anywhere else, so it was tough to kind of tear my attention away from the images sign-wise and get everything else. But I think the book gives a pretty good rounded view of what this stuff is.
I have to ask, since we're here, there's so many places here that are just, you know, family, single family kind of apartments. But the Panoramic actually has quite a few people staying here. So do you have a sense of, like, who's choosing to stay in one of these motels versus one of these single family apartments?
Largely, it's the people that stayed there when they were kids. And this was the same for my family. When I was photographing the Flame Inn, which is one of the shots in the book, it's got a huge candle with a neon flame on top as its sign. When I was photographing that motel, the manager took me into the lobby and showed me a bookshelf that was in the lobby. And it was basically solid from end to end with photo albums of families that had stayed there year after year. And so he helped me to get them down, and we flipped through them, and you could see aunts and uncles and grandparents coming year after year, and kids growing up into adults and bringing their own kids down. And I think that's a lot of what the clientele is people who've just stayed here for years, and it's become a family tradition. So one of the things I think is most interesting about the Wildwood motels is that they were built very economically. Most of these places were simply concrete and cinder block with a little bit of stucco on the outside. And so in the vein of that, the owners would use very economical means to differentiate themselves. As you can see from some of the colors on these motels, definitely from the signage and from the evocative name, they'd all use those as differentiators. But the Caprice across the street here and the Monaco that we're standing in front of go one step further with that. And they use light to actually be a differentiator, especially in the evening when a lot of people who would be driving down in their cars would be looking for a motel. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't like you call and make reservations. Much of this was done on the spur of the moment, and you could stay a single night, which is almost unheard of anymore. You come now and stay for a week the way we vacation. But the nighttime beacon of the motel was very integral to preserving the business. And the Monaco, as you can see from those purple bars that are above the walkway on the second and the first floor here, they're filled with, each has a fluorescent tube, but the outside is a purple lens. And so at night, this entire corner of the block is bathed in sort of an orchidy purple light. Unlike any other motel in Wildwood, you knew when you were getting to the Monaco because you could see the purple glow. The same thing with the Caprice across the street. Its counterpart was this sort of deep blue glow. And again, just all you need to do is lens your lighting correctly, which you have to have anyway to guide people to their rooms, and you've got another economic differentiator of your motel. That sort of newfound post-war prosperity only went so far. And most of these places, the names of which these folks, my family included, could never have afforded to take everybody to the Singapore or to Waikiki or Monaco or the Isle of Capri, all of which are Wildwood motel names. But we could afford to spend a summer afternoon on the AstroTurf around the pool down the Wildwood Beach. And there's something incredibly endearing about that to me. And it's one of the reasons that I think these motels deserve to be appreciated and preserved because of what they meant to us culturally in that place and that time.
That was Mark Havens, a photographer whose latest monograph, Out of Season, is out now from Booth Clip-On Editions. Crossrail is the only new line to be added to London's underground rail network in the past 30 years. And as well as engineers digging the tunnels and laying the tracks, the project has required architects and designers to draw the blueprints for the city's subterranean stations. Section D stalwart James Taylor Foster is the European Editor-at-Large at architecture website ArcDaily, and he spoke to Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan about the Crossrail project and what's in the pipeline.
You have to, first of all, get a sense of this project. It's the largest infrastructure project in Europe, or it has been for the years that it's been going on. It's cost more than the London Olympics, something like an estimated £5 billion. It's a labyrinthine collection of underground tunnels, of chimneys and risers, and spaces, architectural spaces, including stations, but including also transit spaces, which will all collectively be eventually called the Elizabeth Line. This has been going on underneath people's feet for years, and the size of it is kind of staggering. You know, 40 terminals, which in itself is a massive architectural project. And actually, these architectural projects have been going on in the shadow of the monumental engineering project of Crossrail itself. The ambition, as you mentioned, of these spaces is to maintain some degree of simplicity and clarity. A visitor should not necessarily even know they were in that space. You must be able to get from the train to the street as efficiently as possible. And this is partly about safety, but it's also about a little bit about the culture and pace of London, you know, a city which doesn't really stand still. And in comparison to other metros and underground rail systems in other major capital cities, there is a massive preoccupation with speed and efficiency when it comes to the London Underground. But within these spaces, there are always occasional moments of interest, and these occasional moments of interest are kind of compacted, usually onto the platforms. These are commonly artworks, and this is the fine balance which the architects are having to strike between a kind of simple, clear space and also something which doesn't feel too sterile. You can't create monumental architectural spaces, you know, like we've seen in the new concourse in King's Cross, where John McCaslin, who are also doing the Bond Street station of Crossrail, made this kind of enormous canopy structure, which is a significant architectural statement. There's no room for that deep, deep underground. And in Tottenham Court Road, which is currently being redone by a London practice called Hawkins Brown, you know, there was a massive discussion surrounding the fact that they removed Eduardo Palazzi's famous murals in the station. There was a massive uproar in the arts and architecture communities, and they've now been reinstated and incorporated back into Hawkins Brown's design. And so you start to get a sense of how difficult this balance is to strike.
I wonder, where do you think the designers and the architects working on these projects, where are they looking for inspiration and for guidance when the projects they're working on are, in many important regards, unprecedented?
It's primarily about wayfinding, and I think that's the one thing you notice when you're going through the London Underground, whether you're going through a very old station or a comparatively recent one. It's really all about signs and colour. And in order for signs and colour to be legible as you're kind of rushing through spaces, it needs to have a fairly neutral background. But at the same time, they're operating within such a kind of condensed field of movement because they are really at the whim of the engineers. There's been stories, amazing engineering stories, of, I think, when Crossrail were digging the tunnel through Tottenham Court Road, or one of the tunnels into Tottenham Court Road, sorry, they had to negotiate with about 3 inches each side of two other tunnels, and they made it within the course of half a millimeter. So there's an enormous amount of extremely precise space making going on. And so if it's that precise, you know, really, in some ways, the architecture is a kind of cosmetic thing more than the kind of actual crafting of space.
James Taylor Foster there, European Editor-at-Large at architecture website Arc Daily, speaking to Monocle's very own Henry Reese Sheridan. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our editor, Alex Funnel, our sound engineer, Weidong Lin, and the show's producer, Henry Reese Sheridan. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember that we're back at the same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at any time at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.